This feature of the Science News Radio Network is coming to you from our studios in Dallas, Texas. Science News is on the air right now.
This is the promise of tomorrow, where people and industry keep up with the business of emerging and nanotechnologies. The fields covered in this series of programs will include energy, defense, aerospace, medicine, semiconductors, and more. For the next hour, Colonel Mason will introduce his experts, and you'll be on the cutting edge of the promise of tomorrow.
And it's so good to be with you again. I want to remind those of you listening on the radio, we can be heard commercial-free at promiseoftomorrow.biz. If you want the latest scoop on what's going on with cyber warfare, you've come to the right place. We've got an Army major who specializes in that from West Point going to be on the show today. And we're going to learn what could be a scary future in cyber warfare. And, of course, we're going to visit the Den of Strangers, get more wisdom from somebody a lot of us never heard of, visit our fountain of useless information we have here on the set in the second half hour, and, of course, at the end of the program, listener comments and the voice of reason. I've got to tell you, I've been reading a really great book titled An Introduction to Cyber Warfare, a Multidisciplinary Approach by Paolo Shakarian. And Janice Shakarian and Andrew Rueff, I think I'm pronouncing Andrew's name correctly. Anyway, it's a super book. It's highly illustrated and is incredibly informative, especially for somebody who wants to know the basics of cyber warfare. We've managed to connect with Paolo Shakarian, one of the authors, and he's agreed to come on the program. Welcome to the show, Paolo.
Thank you, Colonel.
So good to have you. Now, I want you to kind of walk us through the book. You know, you start out by saying that Many people believe that cyber warfare, that any moment the world's computers could be set into chaos by some clever teenager someplace working out of his basement or garage. And the other extreme, there are those who think that cyber warfare is way overhyped, just exaggerated by security firms and other people to get rich. So you say it falls somewhere in between. Give us kind of a primer here of your book.
Yeah, and I think you're right. I think like many things in life, you know, what cyber warfare actually is does fall somewhere between the world being plunged into chaos by some random hacker and, you know, a conspiracy consisting of a bunch of hype propagated by big companies. And what we really sought to show in the book is how cyber warfare has actually been conducted in about the last decade or so. You know, I not only teach at West Point, but I actually studied here myself when I was undergrad, and one of the courses I took was the military history class, and it was about the time Stuxnet came out, and I started reading some of the stuff, and I turned to my wife Yana, who's my co-author, and I said, you know, there's no military history about cyber warfare. People are just saying anything they want because there's no compendium of what has actually occurred previously. So we of course talked a lot about it, and we set out to decide, you know, what should be in the history of cyber war. Well, first thing we thought we should talk about the major cyber attacks that occurred that are known to have been politically motivated.
Oh yeah.
And talk about the involved actors, and this has included things like the Russian hackers' cyber attacks launched against Estonia in 2007, mm-hmm. the cyber attacks against Georgia in 2008, the cyber war that has occurred between the Israelis and Hezbollah, as well as the Israelis and Hamas in recent years, as well as the cyber attacks by the hacking group Anonymous and other related groups such as LulzSec.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that covers the attack portion. Of course, there is a lot of incidents that have occurred that deal with espionage, whether it is sort of intellectual property or of sensitive information. And we start out this part of the book by, of course, talking about China, which in recent months has gained a lot of notoriety due to things like the Mandiant Report for some of their hacking activities.
Mm-hmm.
So we explore that in much detail. And then we look at some other related incidents of cyber espionage. We look at how the feeds of the Predator drone were stolen by Iraqi insurgents during the war.
Oh, wow.
We look at some of the advanced malware that's been discovered in the wild, such as Flame and Gauss. We also look at how intelligence is collected on social online social networks. And then in the final part of the book, we talk about what is perhaps the most worrying threat of all, and that is cyber attacks launched against physical systems, which include the power grid and industrial systems. And here we talk about some of the research that has been done with regard to power grid systems, such as the Department of Energy's Aurora test a couple years back, as well as what people are saying about the vulnerabilities of the power grid to things like cascading failure. And we also talk about Stuxnet, which is, you know, the most well-known incident of a piece of malware actually affecting a physical system in the real world. So that's essentially what we decided to do with this book.
Yeah, and I love the way you do the build-up to Stuxnet, and I want to get into that for just a minute, but I want to back up a little bit. Most of us are pretty familiar with the denial of services, the flooding of computer systems with just an incredible amount of data coming from all different sources, and how that shuts them down and that sort of thing. And that's been going on now for a while. But I think one of the things that was interesting to me that I hadn't realized, and that's the Predator drone interception, so that our enemies actually are getting the same information that we are in the Predator, drone operations. And I'd like you to get into that a little bit for our listeners, because I think that's something that hasn't been covered very well in the press.
Yeah. So what happened was there were some U.S. soldiers in Iraq who had done a raid against the militia headquarters, and they found amongst the contraband that they took out of this headquarters computer systems. And on the computer systems were video footage of what the operator of a Predator drone sees when it's flying overhead. And so what had happened was the Predator at that time was relying on commercial satellite infrastructure to send its feeds back to the operator who was watching it.
Okay.
And these feeds were, at the time, unencrypted.
Mm.
So the Shiite militia group that was using this was using a piece of software called SkyGrabber that would intercept these satellite signals, which were free in the air, and it was able to decode them and see the video. So, of course, this created a big stir, and there was some controversy because it was actually known that the Predator feeds were unencrypted back in the war in the Balkans, where a British man was actually able to intercept the feeds, and that made some press. But the bug was not closed in the intervening years between the two conflicts. So, I mean, this is an important thing because here the information is actually captured during transmission, so the insurgents could actually see what was of interest to the Americans at the time in the conflict. So, again, it's just another dimension of this new type of warfare that we have to be concerned about as we move forward to try to understand it.
And what was it? We didn't think people were sophisticated enough to figure out how they could go ahead and grab it off the bird like we were doing.
Yeah, and that's a big problem in security. There's a notion that security experts refer to as what's called security by obscurity, which means I'm going to handle my information in such an unusual way that even though it's not inherently secured, it's not using things like cryptography, that people are not going to be likely to steal my information. And this is not a good strategy, because if someone really wants your information, they can figure out your complex system that doesn't involve good security practices and still steal it anyway. You've just obscured it. You haven't actually protected anything. And I think this is a very dangerous mindset that people get into. And maybe with Trump, by other things such as, you know, the bandwidth of the communication, they wanted to maximize it somehow by not encrypting it. Or something like this may have trumped it. And, you know, the downside is that they just didn't have the foresight to see that someone would try to steal these seats. And again, they were embracing the notion of security by obscurity, and we paid the price because our information was compromised in this case.
Security by obscurity. I love that that term. That was something that you kind of filled me in on when we were planning this program, and I'm going to want to talk more about it. But right now, I pointed out about how you did such a great lead up to Stuxnet, and saying about how, you know, we really knew that there was no way in the world that that the people could do anything like what happened with Stuxnet. And you mentioned that it came out of Belarus, and I'd like to have you explain a little bit more on that. But then somehow information, I'm getting this, it got in to Iran through some Siemens hardware and maybe a thumb drive or something. And you know, how did that happen? And you know, who was responsible? I mean, everybody's pointing their fingers at Israel and the United States, but nobody's fessing up as to the ones that have done it. And I think that maybe before you start answering all these questions, for the listeners that are not familiar exactly how Stuxnet works or the damage it does, maybe you can give us a kind of a brief overview.
Yeah, I'll start with a brief overview of Stuxnet, and then I'll address some of the things you brought up.
Okay.
So, essentially, how Stuxnet is what's called a worm, which means it's a piece of malicious software designed to go from one computer system to another in order to eventually get to a certain target. Now, the so the way the centrifuges in the Iranian fuel enrichment plant worked is they had some controller hardware that was controlling the rates and the timing of how the centrifuges would spin. And this controlling hardware had some computer chips in it, and there were some software on these computer chips that would govern these processes. Now, every so often, it became important for the engineers to update the software on these computer chips, and they would do it by disconnecting these pieces of hardware from the centrifuges and connecting them to a standard Windows computer through a USB port.
Okay.
Now, the Iranians, they didn't want malicious software infecting the systems that were governed the centrifuges, so they made sure that the computer systems they would connect the centrifuge hardware to would be disconnected from the internet. So their assumption was, by isolating the computer system, they would protect it from malicious activity, mm-hmm. from pieces of software. So they have this closed system, right? So they have hardware that governs the centrifuges. When they needed to update it, they disconnect from the centrifuges, connect it to the Windows computer, and transfer new instructions. Okay?
Okay.
So what Stuxnet did is it was designed to propagate amongst computer systems in a local area network,
mm-hmm.
as well as through USB memory sticks. And it did this by taking advantages of flaws in the Microsoft Windows operating system that are referred to as zero-day vulnerabilities. And these are vulnerabilities in a piece of software that have largely gone unidentified before the inventor of the malicious software took advantage of them,
mm-hmm.
which means that these vulnerabilities are not patched by the makers of the operating system, and software that leverages them is typically not identified by things like antivirus in their signature, because these are such new ways of taking advantage of these flaws. So by taking advantage of these flaws in how Microsoft Windows handled USB memory sticks, the Stuxnet worm was able to travel from a computer system that was connected to the internet to a computer system that was isolated, hence these systems used to update the software for the centrifuges. So once it resides on the computer system that interfaces with the centrifuge, Stuxnet launched another attack where it attacked the software made by Siemens that interfaced between the Windows computer and the centrifuge controlling hardware. And so it would allow, so once the engineer had it connected, he would send his own instructions, the engineer would send his instructions from the Windows computer to the centrifuge hardware, and the Siemens software would report back to the engineer that, okay, everything has been updated. But Stuxnet was actually issuing a false report, and it was going ahead and it was sending its own stuff to the centrifuge controllers. So then the Stuxnet once it was on the controller, and it would go into the centrifuge, it would do its own thing. Now, there were two versions of Stuxnet, one of which would try to really speed up the centrifuges in a way to try to bring physical damage in a more immediate fashion. Okay. And there was another version that was much more subtle and would periodically spin the centrifuges above the allowable threshold.
Mm-hmm.
So the security experts think that one version was to cause immediate havoc, while the other was to cause more sporadic interruptions that would be difficult to attribute to the software as the mm-hmm. problem. What it turned out is it seems that the version that caused the more immediate damage is what had the impact, and many of the Iranian centrifuges were taken offline, and according to reports by the IAEA, they believe Stuxnet was the cause of this, and of course the Iranians themselves have made statements alluding to a computer worm in their system. So this is why many people think it was successful. I guess the real point of all this is that in the 90s, many people thought that this kind of thing just wouldn't happen,
mm-hmm.
That it was beyond the scope of what was feasible. And one thing that was cited was these systems are very complicated. It's very hard to create a piece of, it's one thing to create a piece of malware that can infect a, Microsoft Windows computer. It's another to do such an advanced attack where you have to account for the software going from computer system to computer system, eventually hitting the target, and then eventually getting onto, the hardware that controls the centrifuges, and not only getting there, but doing something that can effectively break the system.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is, doing this would require a lot of specific knowledge about the centrifuge hardware, the Siemens software, as well as Microsoft Windows, which is beyond what most hackers are capable of doing. So there would have to be a lot of money invested in this, and there would have to be a lot of trial runs done and very expensive mock-ups and things like this. But Stuxnet appears in many regards to have kind of pulled this off. And that's why a lot of people think that the perpetrator was, perhaps a government or a very large corporation with big pockets to pull this off.
Yeah, I can see now why they would point their fingers at somebody like Israel or the United States or something like that. And let me get some clarification here. Did I hear you say that it wasn't smuggled in on a thumb drive, USB drive or something, but it was actually fed into a computer that was connected to the Internet at one time and sat dormant until that computer was then introduced to the local area network?
So what we know about Stuxnet is we know it can spread throughout a local area network, and we know it can spread through USB memory sticks.
Mm-hmm.
And we also know at some point Stuxnet got on the Internet and was spread around there as well. What we don't know for sure is how it initially got on the computer system that connected to the controlling hardware. Well, we know it got on that computer system through the USB memory stick since it was isolated, but we don't know how it got there. We don't know if someone smuggled the USB memory stick into the facility and covertly put it on those systems to make sure those systems were infected. We don't know if some Iranian engineer accidentally downloaded it on the Internet and was maybe taking work home with him through a memory stick and then using that same memory stick on the other computer system. We don't know if it was maybe smuggled in and infected a computer system on a local area network at the facility that was still isolated and propagated through there until it reached one of these isolated systems just through a happen chance memory stick. We just don't know this, any of this for sure. There have been plenty of theories, but I'm not going to speculate.
Wow, that's pretty incredible. I would think the Iranians are going to want to know. Of course, maybe they're safeguarding against all three scenarios. I don't know. But and you said in the book that the original worm was developed or came out of or something came out of Belarus. Is that correct?
Well, no. What happened was it was a security firm in Belarus that was the first one to discover the malicious software. Mm-hmm. And the way they discovered it is they noticed that they're on a USB memory stick that was reported to be infected, that there was something fishy going on, and then they investigated and they discovered the presence of Stuxnet on there. And once they discovered Stuxnet was spreading through USB memory sticks on Windows machines, they investigated, well, what was this designed to do? And then one thing led to another, and it was found that it was designed to hit the Siemens systems, and, you know, and the rest is history. So they were the ones to discover it. They are not credited with inventing it.
Okay, so is Stuxnet still out there on the internet, floating around in the ethers, and could be harmful again if somebody were to connect with it?
I kind of doubt that the current version of Stuxnet is effective at all, because as far as harming something, because now it's known what it does. Whoever made Stuxnet has likely moved on and developed something else to conduct operations if they're looking to do similar operations to this. I mean, I'm sure there's still copies out there, but that's already been so long ago in terms of, you know, computer security, that all that the vulnerability, the zero-day vulnerabilities in Windows and Siemens have since been closed, and antivirus software now can identify the signatures of it. So, you know, it's in terms of computer security, sort of say old news. But that being said, you know, Stuxnet also was highly sophisticated in that it was, in many ways, if you view it as a piece of munition, it was a smart munition, because Stuxnet would only, once it finally reached all the way to the hardware system that controlled the centrifuges, it would check for a very specific configuration of hardware. And it would only launch the attack if that specific configuration was identified. So that's why there were other people, Stuxnet was actually found on this type of hardware in other countries, I believe in Germany and I think maybe even China. But the attack was never launched. And Siemens actually put out a report that said of all the incidents that were reported to Siemens, and Iran likely didn't report the incidents to Siemens since their Siemens software was bundled as part of a larger package provided by a Russian firm who would have provided the tech support.
Yeah.
So if everyone reported directly to Siemens, no one had any effect from Stuxnet, because their systems were configured a little differently than the Iranians. And so that's another thing that's interesting about Stuxnet. Not only did whoever make it have a lot of money to create such a sophisticated piece of software, but they also had a lot of intelligence to better understand their target so they could tailor the malware to the target, which is also kind of interesting. And again, it indicates someone with a lot of resources, was behind this attack.
Well, someone, you know, or the group of someones who worked on this thing have got to be sitting around chuckling, because they know the answer to these questions. And somebody, like maybe an Edward Snowden or somebody else, someday are going to have to fess up and come out and say, this is what we did and this is how we did it, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, that might happen. I mean, I don't know what kind of repercussions there would be. I mean, again, I would just be speculating, and this is kind of one of the things I wanted to get away from in the book, is I wanted to avoid speculation and only include incidents in the book where we had a lot of facts and we could draw a picture as to what happened and, you know, why we think certain things like Stuxnet and other attacks were effective, as opposed to, finger pointing and this sort of thing. And so we really made an effort to reduce that in our book.
Well, you did a fine job of that, really, sticking to the facts and everything else. And on this program, we do kind of like to look to the future a little bit, and I want to return to do a thorough job of that in the second half hour. Okay. As we walk to the break at the half hour, we're going to pause at the door of the Den of Strangers, where we keep locked away all the wisdom of mankind. In the Den of Strangers, will we meet today?
A Leo CERN. The computer is incredibly fast, accurate, and stupid. Man is unbelievably slow, inaccurate, and brilliant. The marriage of the two? Oh, it's a force beyond calculation.